Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
On the program today, money and politics, politics and money. Almost can't have one without the other, can you? Where things stand with the finances of the GOP. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 10th of October. Glad, as always, you could be with us, everybody. Today in campaign 2016, this item. The Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives, Paul D. Ryan of Wisconsin, said to his caucus, in essence, do what you got to do to get reelected. Forget the top of the ticket. Let's save the GOP majority in the House. Ryan's move, of course, comes in the wake of the last 72 hours in the campaign of GOP nominee Donald Trump. We are going to do what we got to do, which is follow the money. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace gets us going with what happens when something like this happens.
It's a scramble. Republicans who once backed Trump are backing out of backing him. Others, like GOP House Leader Paul Ryan, are saying they're not backing him, but won't defend him or appear with him at events. Meanwhile, the Republican National Committee has doubled down on supporting the candidate. So with the House of Cards really seriously collapsing like this, what happens to fundraising?
We're now at a point where it's kind of every man for himself.
Republican consultant Mac Makowiak says with Trump down in the polls, Republicans are worried about losing Congress entirely. So they'll probably double down on those races with or without Trump's help.
There's a kind of panic setting in among Republicans.
Robert Shrum, a politics professor at the University of Southern California and a longtime Democratic strategist, says House and Senate candidates could actually see a bump from donors who abandoned Trump.
They will take all their money and pour it into congressional and Senate races.
At the end of August, the RNC had $40 million on hand, around half of what it had at this time in 2012 or 2008. But it's also pretty late in the game to think about shifting a strategy for how to spend that money. Christina Greer, a poli-sci professor at Fordham, says there's one clear winner here in terms of fundraising as this macabre series of events unfolds, and that's Hillary Clinton.
I do think that she can use a lot of what Donald Trump said. Oh, it's just locker room talk. Oh, I don't pay my taxes. Oh, I'm going to send you to jail. You know, this kind of bullying persona that he has to raise money.
Clinton's campaign has consistently outfundraised Trump, although Trump has raked in the most free media coverage of any candidate in history. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
There was an interesting moment in tax policy in the debate last night. The candidates were asked this question.
Good evening. My question is, what specific tax provisions will you change to ensure the wealthiest Americans pay their fair share in taxes?
Mr. Trump got first whack at the answer. Here's how he started.
Well, one thing I do is get rid of carried interest.
Interestingly enough, that might be the only place that Mr. Trump and Secretary Clinton agree tax-wise. The carried interest exemption, as it's known, is a favorite of private equity types and hedge fund managers. Marketplace's Annie Baxter explains what it's all about.
The term carried interest may be a bit confusing. You might wonder, what is the interest at stake? What exactly is it carried over from? And am I going to have to do math? But it turns out the origins of the term are refreshingly easy to understand.
The idea goes back several centuries to when sea captains would carry cargo on behalf of business people to foreign ports and sell it.
Donald Marin is a tax expert at the Urban Institute. He says a ship captain used to get a cut of profits for transporting goods safely.
That was his carried interest for carrying the cargo to the foreign port. And the basic principle has kept that name ever since.
In today's world, it's more like captains of industry we're talking about. The managers or general partners of private equity, venture capital, and real estate funds. Doug Shackelford is a tax professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
The general partner is the one that's going to be helping manage these companies, provide knowledge, expertise, etc.
So, like the ship captain who got his special cut of profits, the general partner is rewarded for expertise. His or her so-called carried interest is taxed as a capital gain at a top rate of about 24%, instead of at the higher rate for ordinary income, like the rest of us pay. But many experts and politicians question, isn't expertise just like work?
To what extent are they really workers who should be receiving wages and salaries for their expertise?
And should those fund managers then be taxed at income rates as high as 44%, way more than capital gains tax rates? I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Our favorite Nobel Prize was announced early this morning, the one for economics. It went to two economists, one British by way of Harvard, the other Finnish by way of MIT, for their work on contract theory, the way that contracts work in real life, and what that means for negotiating good ones. Contract theory is about getting the best bang for your buck. And really, who shouldn't get a Nobel Prize for making that easier? From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong is on that one.
Nobel laureate number one, Bengt Holmstrom of MIT, in part for his work on labor contract incentives. Here's an example. Say you run a factory. You might pay each worker per thing produced. Makes sense. But would you pay a teacher based on student test scores? Here's economist Steve Tadelis at Berkeley.
Possibly not, because we want them to, you know, raise our kids to be creative, to be mensches. You will force them to just spend all their energy on that one thing, because that's what they're getting paid for.
Awardee number two, Oliver Hart of Harvard. He focused on contracts and uncertainty. Now say you run a local government. You might privatize trash pickup and find it saves money. Then privatize a prison and find the prisoners aren't fed enough. Understanding these trade-offs is hugely important, says Roger Meyerson of the University of Chicago, himself a past Nobel Economics winner.
The right answer is not privatize everything. The right answer is not have collective ownership for everything. A good theory needs to be able to go both ways, precisely the kind of theory we need to understand the real world.
This prize is not just about theory. Holmstrom and Hart's work helps people to write and negotiate good contracts. This being baseball season, some of the stars are in their last contract years and looking for the next one. Here's Jonathan Levin, economist at Stanford.
They have tremendously strong incentives to perform at the very highest level. In the first year of a 10-year contract, maybe the incentives are a little weaker because their pay is guaranteed for the next 10 years.
Contract theory helps a team structure deals and maximize its investment. Understanding the money ball of life is what this year's prize is about. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, lots of buying contracts. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The latest news out of Haiti in the wake of Hurricane Matthew is not good. As many as 1,000 people dead, according to reports, whole towns wiped out, and a looming cholera outbreak as well. If you've been thinking about how you might help, so have a whole lot of other people, and there are plenty of organizations gearing up to take your money. But Haiti has a complicated history when it comes to aid. Jonathan Katz was the Associated Press bureau chief in Haiti during the earthquake 6 years ago. His book about that quake and the aid that followed is called The Big Truck That Went By. Jonathan, thanks for coming on the program.
Good to be here.
There is a disconnect between, as the drive for aid gets mounted here, there is a disconnect between that public and private aid and conditions on the ground. And it seems like it has been for years and years and years.
Yeah, I think there's some fundamental misunderstandings about the way that aid works. We have this humanitarian aid industry, and that industry is constantly functioning. It just gets into a slightly higher gear. And really, the work that those aid groups do is never really intended to make the long-term systemic difference that's necessary in order to help the country face the next disaster to come.
Well, that's exactly it. It's one thing to put a roof over somebody's head on day three after an earthquake or a hurricane, and it's another thing to put a roof over their head 5 years later.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you need systems, you need institutions, you need all kinds of things that don't exist in Haiti. And one of the things that I think that people often don't understand is the way that the aid industry actually undercuts the ability of people in Haiti and in places like Haiti to do those things. So, like, for instance, you will often see aid groups that are coming in and, you know, they'll provide certain kinds of shelter, right? Or mm-hmm. they'll provide medical aid or maybe they'll provide some kind of food. And what that does when you do it over the long term is it actually degrades the ability of the institutions in the country itself to function.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, in the next like 36 hours, if it hasn't started already, there will be those pleas that say, you know, text this number to this number and you'll give $10.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, President Obama, just the other day at the White House, you know, he was extending his sympathy to the people of Haiti, and he was asking people to chip in. And the people that he told Americans to donate their money to was the American Red Cross. And when I saw that, like, I almost dropped my phone out of my hand. Like, the way that I would describe what happened to the $500 million that the American Red Cross got after the earthquake is that they did more or less what they did. Told people they were going to do with it. They just told people in a kind of misleading way. So people give money. They give their $5, $10, $20, or if you know you're Leonardo DiCaprio or something, you give a whole bunch more to the American Red Cross. And you sort of have this picture in your mind that the American Red Cross is going to go down and build houses. But the American Red Cross doesn't build houses. It's not a construction firm. Like, that's not what they do. But what they mean when they talk about providing shelter 99% of the time is handing out tarps to people so that they can put over their heads. And when those tarps fray, they then hand out more tarps and they keep handing out tarps until they've run out of shelter money and no house gets built. But no house was ever supposed to get built.
This is a much broader question than the scope of this conversation is. But let's focus it on Haiti for a minute. Have we failed Haiti in the aid that we give or that we try to give?
I think we've failed Haiti in a lot of ways. It's a really complex failure. It is impossible to look at that and pick two people or 10 people or even one country to say this is all of their fault. But clearly this is a situation where if you look at it and you take a step back, you can see that everyone has failed.
Jonathan Katz was the Associated Press Bureau Chief in Haiti at the time of the earthquake. His book about that and the aid that followed is called The Big Truck That Went By. Jonathan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Obamacare came up a couple of times last night, either in the it's terrible and we got to repeal and replace it context or in the it needs some fixing context. One of the big healthcare pushes by the Obama administration has been to get doctors and hospitals to ditch all their paper records and go digital, be more efficient and save some money. One $30 billion investment by the federal government later, most hospitals and physicians do have electronic healthcare record systems. The catch is that software vendors who sell these things sometimes tuck fees, some small, some big, some hidden, into the contracts. So the Department of Health and Human Services has released sort of a how-to-negotiate guide to help doctors and hospitals sidestep contractual minefields and not get trapped in the fine print. From the Health Desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
When the Arkansas Verdigris Valley Health Centers in Oklahoma bought their electronic health record system, they were thrilled. Then Marcus Johnson, who heads up IT, says they saw the software vendor's contract.
The gibberish in the contracts that they sent. Good luck reading that.
Johnson says they assumed they'd finally be able to track all their patients as they got care all around Tulsa. Instead, they got schooled in the art of a bad deal.
To send out a alert to a patient to say they have an appointment, it's 10 cent per message.
And that's not all. To share patient data, they'd have to pay a one-time $750 facility fee and $50 a month for every nurse and doctor who wanted to share data. All told, it'd be $50,000. $50,000 the clinic didn't have. So for the last 6 years, patient data may as well have been kept on paper.
This story is very common, unfortunately. So it's a problem.
That's Andy Slavitt, head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Plenty of small practices deal with some of the largest software companies on the planet. The new guide, says Slavitt, flags common tricks like one-time connection fees and offers physicians negotiating advice.
We're publishing a list of best practices so that they can be incorporated into the contracts that people use.
Back in Oklahoma, Marcus Johnson says they've quit their old vendor. The clinic has hired a new company that guarantees data will follow the patient, and the clinic can even send out those appointment reminders for free. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You are feeling it in your chest. You actually physically feel them. You don't just hear them.
Tourists in New York City. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 88 points, about a half percent, 18,329. The NASDAQ gained 36.6 tenths percent, 5328. The S&P 500 up 9 points, 4 tenths percent, 21.63. We've been dissecting last night's debate a bit. One way to track it, try looking at the Mexican peso rallied 2% against the dollar today, showed some optimism for a Clinton victory. Meanwhile, Russia has agreed to cap oil production to help boost prices. The news sent the price of Brent crude barreling up to the highest it's been in a year, nearly $53. Also means a big ka-ching for Exxon, up almost 2% today. Drug maker Mylan was given a shot in the arm after it agreed to settle allegations that it overcharged Medicaid for its EpiPens. It's going to cost the company $485 million, but investors were happy. Mylan up just over 8% today. Nothing doing on the bond market. Bupkis, not a Zippo, closed for Columbus Day. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We've done a bunch of stories on this program about how this economy is changing, about manufacturing and high tech and the skills economy. Here's a slice of it, though, that doesn't get a whole lot of attention, but is arguably the biggest change of them all. Around the turn of the last century, 35% of Americans lived on farms. Today, that's about 1%, maybe just a hair more. What's funny about it, though, is that interest in farming is still really strong. Case in point, a group now known as FFA, but more traditionally called Future Farmers of America, is growing by leaps and bounds. Marketplace's Adam Allington has that story.
You can easily spot a kid in FFA by the iconic blue corduroy jackets they all wear. 17-year-old Isaiah Nance is wearing his. We're about 10 miles south of Washington, D.C., the suburbs, essentially. But Nance has given me a quick lesson in tobacco farming.
You have to rotate the tobacco every year to have healthy crops.
We're at an educational farm preserve in Accokeek, Maryland. Nance works at the farm through an FFA internship. The worst thing about growing tobacco, he tells me, are the little green hornworms. But he has a solution.
The hornworms usually just eat up the tobacco leaves. So we're trying to get guinea fowl over here in this location to cut down on the hornworms.
Guinea fowl. They kind of look like a small peacock and love to eat hornworms. Over the past decade, FFA's growth has been strongest in suburban communities like this, as well as in large cities like Chicago and Philadelphia.
When we first started the program, people kind of looked at us sideways and said, well, you know, what are you going to plow up 301?
That would be U.S. Route 301 outside of D.C., and the man speaking is Donald Bell. He's the FFA coordinator with Prince George's County Public Schools. After the 1980s farm crisis, FFA shifted focus from vocational farm skills, putting more emphasis on science and technology, which Bell says helped it expand out from rural areas and into cities.
We have a lot of students that are interested in animal science. We have a lot of students that are interested in biochemistry or food science, all of which are still related to agriculture.
There are over 640,000 students in FFA, the most they've ever had, and about 25% more than just 6 years ago. Mark Peschel is the CEO of FFA. I asked him if he still got his blue corduroy jacket.
I do, and in fact, I'm looking at my FFA jacket as we speak, hanging above my desk.
Even though actual farm jobs account for just over 1% of all jobs in the U.S., Peschel says roughly 1 in 12 is agriculture-related, and FFA students are on the fast track to fill those jobs.
A company like John Deere, in their precision agriculture unit, employs over 2,500 computer programmers to help them develop their next generation of farming equipment.
And it isn't just John Deere that's looking for a new kind of labor force. Paul Lightfoot is the CEO of Bright Farms, an ag tech startup. He's having such a hard time finding qualified workers, he's taken matters into his own hands.
We're actually creating a huge apprentice grower force just because we don't trust that the market's going to give us good growers.
Lightfoot's company just raised over $30 million to build industrial-scale greenhouses to supply year-round salad greens to large cities. He says he likes FFA's emphasis on food science along with other skills like logistics and communication, which he says aren't being taught at most horticulture and agriculture programs.
None of those are producing what I want, which are food growers in greenhouses, but who really understand almost like a manufacturing process culture.
Back on the farm in Akakeek, 17-year-old Tyler Reed walks me through a vegetable garden that she planted.
Some spinach is over here, some beans and stuff like that.
Unlike FFA members of the past, it's been a long time since someone in her family's lived on a farm.
I mean, personally, I didn't grow up on a farm, but like my great-grandfather had like pigs and stuff.
And while she has no desire to raise livestock, she is studying to be an environmental engineer, and working on the farm is a nice break from all the lab and science classes she has in school. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
You know those double-decker tour buses they have in a lot of big cities? Sometimes the second deck has no roof, all the better to sightsee by. In New York, those buses could not be more passé. The helicopter tourism industry is booming in the Big Apple, with tens of thousands of visitors paying big bucks for a bird's-eye view of the city. The catch, of course, is that with helicopters comes helicopter noise and unhappy locals. A compromise has been worked out, but nobody is happy about it. From New York, Adrian Ma explains.
People come from all over the world to get a glimpse of New York's iconic skyscrapers. But for some of them, the old double-decker bus just doesn't cut it. So they pay anywhere from $200 to $2,000 a pop for a ride in one of these. After taking off from a heliport at the southern tip of Manhattan, the choppers ferry tourists up and down the Hudson River for an Instagrammable view of the city.
What better way to see New York City than via the sky?
That's Taylor Holland from Sydney, Australia.
Amazing photos. Loved every minute.
Chopper tour operators say business has taken off in the past few years, with nearly 60,000 tours given in just the past year. If you only count the hours they're allowed to fly, that's an average of one chopper every 3.5 minutes. Of course, as chopper tours increased, so did the noise complaints. And in response to pressure from community activists, the city's now forcing tours to cut their flights in half. Karen McDermott lives on the west side, right along the tour's flight path. And she says she'd rather see them banned completely. Even though she grew up near LaGuardia Airport and was used to the sound of planes, she says helicopters are different.
You are feeling it in your chest. You actually physically feel them. You don't just hear them.
Standing in her living room recently, even with the windows closed, I could feel a low vibration with each passing helicopter.
So as high as I put my music or if I put on the TV, it doesn't matter. I've literally gone into the bathtub and gone under the water to get away from them, and I can hear them under the water.
I'm not here to say they're not hearing noise, because a helicopter makes sounds.
Sam Goldstein is a lobbyist for the 5 helicopter tour companies that operate in Manhattan. He says the tours have been great for the city. As evidence, he points to an NYU study funded by an industry group called the Eastern Region Helicopter Council. Using data from the helicopter companies, the study estimated that the tours generated about $30 million in economic activity for the city back in 2010. And Goldstein says that number's probably higher now.
You know, we offer a great product which people come here and they demand. The numbers show it. You know, and you have hundreds of thousands of people who come here and take a tour. That's undeniable.
He also says the companies employ more than 200 pilots, mechanics, and sales staff. So as they see their business chopped in half, they may also have to cut jobs.
It's tough on our operators and tough on our businesses. 50% can be really, in a lot of cases, a near fatal cut. But we worked with the city to find something that we think will be able to keep us operating and make the community get some noticeable relief.
When I spoke to Goldstein in August, tours had already been cut by 20%. So I decided to check in with Karen McDermott to see if she was getting some relief. As it turned out, her apartment was a lot quieter, but mostly because she'd spent about $25,000 on new insulated windows.
That's with the window open.
Okay. And that's with the window closed.
It definitely makes a difference.
Yeah, that's why they were $25,000.
And if McDermott wants it to stay quiet, she'll need to keep those windows closed a lot of the time. Even with the chopper tours cut in half, that's still about 30,000 helicopters that'll buzz past her building next year. In New York, I'm Adrian Ma for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out, Carl Icahn brought down the curtain on Donald Trump's tenure in Atlantic City, New Jersey today. Icahn, mention of whom is usually preceded by the phrase activist investor, bought the Trump Taj Mahal Casino Resorts and some other Trump properties out of bankruptcy in 2014. Today, though, enough was enough. Icahn, a friend and supporter of the GOP nominee, called it a sad day, said he lost $350 million and that he was shutting it all down. All righty, got to go. The Dow up 88 points today, 0.4%. The Nasdaq up 36.6 tenths%. The S&P 500 up 9 points, about 0.4%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.